This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Today's podcast is sponsored by FastBitcoins.com. FastBitcoins provides a simple way for people to buy Bitcoin directly from their bank account or with cash in physical stores. Their services are rapidly growing in availability across the UK, Estonia, as well as Canada, and they're launching in Australia soon too. FastBitcoins is committed to providing high-quality Bitcoin-only services. They want to make sure that the growing number of people interested in buying and benefiting from the possibilities of Bitcoin can do so easily, securely, and with as few distractions as possible. Learn more about FastBitcoin's range of services at fastbitcoins.com, including how you can earn Bitcoin for free through their referral scheme. That is fastbitcoins.com. Fastbitcoins.com, go check them out.
I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the grand, stuntly you're destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a super interesting guy. He has been a teacher in China for many years. He's got a big YouTube channel with over 500,000 subscribers where he makes videos in English and in also very impressive Chinese language as well. And this is Mike Goffman, aka Teacher Mike. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, man. Thanks for having me on. Super excited.
Awesome. Big man. Fan. I'm excited to have you here, so I appreciate that, bro. Thank you.
I'm trying my best not to fanboy.
So I've just done a really brief intro there. So tell people a little bit more about who you are and what you do.
So I've taught and lived in China for 10 years now, and I started as an English teacher, you know, way back when in 2007 was the first time I taught over there. And I guess the requirement for teaching was relatively low. They just kind of wanted native speakers. And I didn't really know much about teaching, to be honest. It was kind of a cool thing to try, kind of a change in career in my life and getting back to traveling. So I did it. I loved it. And then later on, I found out, you know, I actually really like teaching. I want to go back to school and get my teaching certificate and be a legit teacher. So I did that. I actually did that in design technology, which is my college background. So I guess I'm kind of a creative designer at heart. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And just over the years in China, teaching English and also teaching design technology, I get a lot of the same English questions over and 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 over. And I see a lot of the same pronunciation mistakes, grammar mistakes. So I just thought, like, I should just start making some videos so that I don't have to like keep explaining this over and over again.
Yeah.
You just refer them to the videos. And
sure.
That was about 5 years ago. So.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about what led you to going to China. I mean, have you always been interested in going to China? Were you already speaking the language in any way? I have seen some of your YouTube videos, and I am certainly no expert on it's Mandarin, right?
Correct.
Yes, I'm certainly no expert on the Mandarin language, but I've seen you've got long videos on YouTube that are 100% in Mandarin. It sounds very impressive to me.
Right? Yeah.
Just that in itself is impressive. I'm obviously not a Chinese native who can be there and be like, oh, he pronounced that one word wrong or whatever.
Right? Yeah,
but,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just very free-flowing, totally fluent. So were you already speaking the language before you went over there? What's the story behind all that?
I did not know a single word, nor did I have any interest in China whatsoever.
Okay.
I was, I guess you would say, a crossroads in life, maybe spiritually and personally and career-wise. And I had a friend over there teaching, a college friend who was teaching English, and he just loved it. And an opportunity presented itself to go on like a two-week mission trip to do English camps.
Okay.
And they're quite common over there in the summer. People go over there and all these kids sign up and they attend all these English classes throughout the day. It's kind of intensive English classes.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, that's awesome. I want to do that. And then the opportunity came up, like, well, they said, do you want to stay and teach for a year. You can teach there. You know, as long as you have a college degree, that's kind of, and you're a native speaker, that's kind of the basic requirement. I don't know. You know, that's kind of a big jump. I just kind of maybe go over there, check it out. And then I was the last at the program at the schools that were hiring. I was like the last one to get signed on. And I kind of made a last minute decision, kind of just stopped what I was doing in the US and went over. And it was back in 2007. And I had, you know, the time of my life. I was making maybe $600 a month. That was a salary. Mm-hmm. You know, I've never been so poor, but never been so happy. it was amazing. People were so friendly.
And where did you go to?
That was in northeastern China, a city called Qinhuangdao, which is straight east. If you're in Beijing and you head east until you hit the ocean, that's where you are. And so it was right next to the beach, which was cool too.
That's awesome, man. So, I mean, what was it like when you first got there? You said you really enjoyed it. What was it? Was it your first time in the country as well?
I don't know. It was just so raw and it was just so different. You know, I was expecting a much different type of architecture and I didn't know what the people would be like. I was obviously had preconceived notions about what the food was like, which mm-hmm. were just, you know, the food is just unbelievable. The real stuff.
Yeah. And, okay. So tell me about what you thought it was going to be like versus what it actually turned out to be like.
I don't know. I guess I just thought, you know, you see these old kung fu movies, you kind of see those old buildings. I thought there was going to be like a bunch of those things. Mm-hmm. And like, I just had no idea how, you know, modern and how much construction was going on and how quickly it was changing and how hospitable and friendly like the people would be. And just like, they just, everybody wants to, you're the guest there, you know, I've said this to people, you know, I've been in China for 10 years, but I'll never be Chinese.
Sure.
I'm always going to be like a guest in their country, which is fine. And, but with that comes a lot of guest treatment and it's just, you know, people are very, I don't want to say naive, very innocent and they just, mm-hmm. you know, they just want to know you.
Yeah.
And, curious. I was just overwhelmed by the friendship, you know, it was great. I loved it.
That's cool, man. And what was it like, initially in terms of the language? Was there a big language barrier or what's the sort of level of English like out there? How were you able to get by?
Yeah, it varies quite a bit. Mm. Naturally, you know, we're teaching English. I was teaching students who are learning English, have learned English. So most of the people I knew could speak English. And I decided pretty early, I had no idea how long I was going to stay, but I decided pretty early I'm gonna start learning Mandarin. Mm. Like, you know, if I'm going to actually live here, like at least make an effort.
Sure.
There's always a language barrier, but again, it wasn't a huge issue because you always had, you know, a dozen people around you like, oh, can I help you? Can I help you with this? Can I help you with that? Mm-hmm. They just really want to help you and just be able to contribute something, you know, that's great.
What was it that surprised you most? What were you most shocked by?
I mean, the food right away is just like, your eyes are like, man, I've been missing out my whole life.
Really? Okay. Tell me more about that.
Like these dumplings. Oh man. Have you had the Chinese dumplings, the real stuff?
Which ones?
You got fried dumplings, which are like pot stickers. You got soup dumplings, which are kind of boiled. There's like pork and veggies.
Okay.
You got the xiaolong bao, which are steamed dumplings.
I know those ones. I'm very familiar with those.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those
like the jiaozi, I think they call them like gyoza in English.
Oh, yes.
I guess.
Yeah. I know
those. Yeah. But just think of that, but like 10 times better and fresh.
Okay.
That just blew me away. So
okay. It
was great. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. So tell me more about learning Mandarin. I mean, how did you go about doing it? How did you go from not speaking a word to being fluent, and especially Mandarin, because we're not talking about French or Spanish or Italian or a language which has a lot of overlap and similarities with your native language and uses the same alphabet as well, which is a big one.
Yeah.
I mean, Chinese, if I look at Chinese writing, if I see the characters, whatever, I mean, it looks like it could be written by aliens. You know, I know it's Chinese, but like, I can't understand one thing, right? If I see a word in, to be fair, you know, I can speak a decent level of French and Spanish, but if I see even Polish, I can at least somewhat pronounce the word because I know how to say the letters. If I see Italian, I don't understand Italian, but I can still read it. If I see Chinese or Japanese or Arabic and whole different alphabet, it's just, you know, it's kind of mind blowing. And then of course, Mandarin. Is Mandarin a tonal language?
Oh yeah.
It's very tonal.
Mandarin has four tones plus a neutral tone. And I believe, I don't know much Cantonese. Cantonese, I believe, has seven tones.
Wow. Yeah. So the whole language structure is totally foreign in every sense of the term. So with all that in mind, yeah, how did you start?
So a couple people there had been there for a couple of years, and so they spoke decent Mandarin already, and they gave me their old books. Mm-hmm. So I had those to start learning characters, where you practice going one stroke at a time, and you end up, you know, writing the same character like, you know, 50 times over. Mm-hmm. And believe it or not, when you look at the Chinese characters, it does look like a lot of just lines everywhere, but there is some rhyme or reason to it.
Okay.
There's different parts that represent different things. Like they call it a radical. So on the left side, you might see a common part of the character in many different characters, which has something to do with water, for example.
Okay.
Or a liquid or something like that. So you can kind of narrow it down that way.
Does each character correspond to a letter like it does in English, or is it a whole different
syllable
system?
I would say a syllable.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And each syllable could have 4 different tones.
Mm-hmm.
And each character could have, you know, 2, 3, 4, up to 10 different meanings, depending on the context or what other characters it's with. I know, dude, it's wild.
I'm already like, okay.
Yeah. I can see your head just exploding. But I also got, I bought these flashcards where you had like 500 of the most common Chinese characters. And I would go through those, you know, I'd try to go through as many of those as I could every day. And so I got up to just like a very, very basic level where I could have very simple conversations probably in about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of people were impressed with that, although there's other people I knew who had gotten much more advanced than I did during that same time.
Yeah.
But they just are very gifted in languages. I don't know. Everybody says that, oh, you're gifted in languages. I don't know. I think I just practiced a lot.
Yeah. I think people say that as an excuse. Talent exists in everything, and there are always going to be some people who are more talented than other things. Mm-hmm. But I look at it this way. Every person, like every child, can learn their native language.
Yeah.
Right. No matter what country they're born in, every child can learn their native language, and every child can also learn multiple languages. And we know that adults are significantly more intelligent and significantly more advanced than children are. So this idea that it's, you know, impossible to learn a language, or some people are just, you know, it's like when
it's
you
a
work,
cop out.
Yeah. When you work really hard at something, it looks like talent, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Right? You know, once you get really, really good at something, people are like, oh, you're just talented at that. And it's like, you know, I've been going to the gym for 16 or 17 years. And I now get people who are like, man, I wish I had your genetics. And I'm like, if you saw me when I first started training, you wouldn't have been like, man, this guy's got crazy genetics. You know what I mean? Yeah. You'd be like, oh, this is just like a, you know, chubby teenager.
And I think like, you know, with someone with my level, I see other people that are even better than me, like other non-Chinese people. And I'm just like, man, I get jealous of them. And I don't know, maybe you probably feel that way about lifting too. It's like, oh man, that guy, maybe I should step it up a little bit more. You know, so you always have somebody
of course
ahead of you that you want to try to aspire to as well.
Mm. So when you started learning, did you go straight to the characters, or did you focus more on speaking and understanding first?
I just went straight to the characters, and I also had someone donated me one of those Pimsleurs.
Oh, Pimsleurs CDs. Fantastic. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So I had those lessons, which are, I do like a half an hour a day, and that lasted me a couple months. And that helps you just get the pronunciation, because you're just listening and repeating, mimicking. And so I had some pronunciation, I had some characters. And then again, you know, I was working at a college, right? So a lot of these college kids didn't have particularly a lot to do. So we would hang out a lot, and they would teach me stuff all the time.
Mm.
You know, I'd teach them some English, more me teaching English than them teaching Chinese, because obviously their English is far superior to my Chinese at the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just always people around who could ask questions and stuff like that.
So did you do any formal lessons at all?
The college I was at, they had a program for foreign students to come and learn Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
But I was teaching, so I couldn't attend it full time, but I went and asked the teachers, like, do you mind if I just like sit down on classes when I'm not teaching English? And they're like, like our students are terrible. Like, we want some people to actually come in and participate.
Yeah.
A lot of people just go there to kind of, you know, they're 19 and just out of high school and away from home, and kind of go screw off. But I would go in there and I'd like, I want to learn some stuff. And the teachers are great. So thankful they let me sit in for nothing, you know.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
So the college you were at, this was mainly was stuff mainly in Chinese language? It was a Chinese college, or was it
correct? More into, yeah, okay. there were programs for learning English, to be an English educator, programs for business English. So a lot of the students I had were going to be either English teachers, mm-hmm. Do some kind of foreign trade where they're learning English. Mm-hmm. I actually had a whole group of stewardesses, I guess you call them, which, you know, they're flying international airlines, so they have to learn English. Mm. They were the worst.
Oh, really?
They just did not care. They just did not care about English one bit.
I thought they'd be the best.
They're too busy fixing their makeup.
I was thinking, I was like, that's a good position to be the alpha male, like, you know.
Yeah, well, yeah, but no teachers wanted to teach them. We were trying to, you know, I'll give you this class if I can.
That's,
you know,
so funny.
Oh man,
that's, yeah, so funny. That's awesome. So tell me more about your progression in the language, because I am curious as to how you was it just day after day, just when did you realize, like, oh, actually I'm fluent? I mean, when did you say that you reached fluency? When I say, sure, fluency, I don't mean perfection. I mean the proper term, right? Being able, yeah, to have a flowing conversation without translating stuff in your head and making, like, mm-hmm, gigantic errors and stuff like that. How long did it take you to reach that level?
I would say, so I went back to the US in 2009. And of course the economy was terrible. I couldn't get a job. Mm. So I'm like, well, I'm just going to go back to China, you know?
Okay.
I went back to China in 2010, started teaching again. And at that point I was like, okay, I'm probably going to be here a little while. Mm. I'm going to hire a tutor. And so I hired a tutor to meet a couple times a week. And my goal was to get to HSK5. So HSK is the standardized Mandarin test for non-native speakers. So there's, mm-hmm, six levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I thought, okay, if I get to level 5, and the levels are like kind of exponentially hard. Okay, it's not just, okay, kind of a gradual thing. So there's a vast difference between level 3 and 4. Mm. And so I studied with her for about 2 years. And I think probably in like 2013, 2014, I took the test, mm, passed it the first time.
Nice.
And I said, if I pass that level, I'm not, my formal study is going to be finished. Everything else, yeah, I do is just going to be with my friends, practicing, just daily conversation. But yeah, I mean, really at the end of the day, you have to force yourself to take, mm, either study or to just be in a Chinese speaking environment, which, yeah, is not terribly difficult to do when you're in China.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool. So, and were you in the same city at that time?
Yeah. I've been in Shanghai since late 2010. So I've been there almost over 9 years, almost, okay, 10 years. Yeah.
That's awesome, man. Well, firstly, yeah, I want to say congratulations. Like, I am impressed by anyone who, I'm impressed by anyone who does anything difficult that requires perseverance.
But thanks, man.
Yeah, but I love languages specifically. I have gone through the process of teaching myself French and Spanish at various points, although they're both kind of rusty because I haven't used them that recently. But I got to a good level at both of them where I was having pretty free-flowing conversations with you know, French and Spanish people, etc. But yeah, I mean, Chinese specifically, because that's one of the scary languages, right? There are certain scary languages, you know, you've got, like,
yeah,
you know, Chinese.
Intimidating.
Yeah, Chinese, Japanese, Russian, Polish, right? There are certain ones where it's just like, oh gosh, like, I don't even.
I read an article that kind of listed out the number of hours it would take a speaker, you know, someone new to a language to become conversational in a language. And I think Spanish was lower, kind of like in that 400 to 500 hour range with French and Italian. And then English was kind of 600-700, or, and then like Chinese and Japanese are like 1200 to 1300.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, you can't even read a simple newspaper, mm-mm, without first learning at least 3000 characters. Right. Yeah.
How many characters I'm getting my head around characters. So are characters, yeah, like words,
mm-hmm,
almost?
Yep.
Okay.
So exactly, words.
Oh, okay. So each character is literally like another word in the vocabulary, essentially.
So I'll give you a few examples. So ni hao, mm-hmm, is literally ni, which means you, mm-hmm, and hao means good. Mm-hmm. So it's hello in Chinese, mm-hmm, you good.
Yeah.
And they're, you know, a lot of the word construction is very practical. I'll give you an example of that, like computer, mm-hmm, is dian nao. Dian means electricity. Mm. Nao means brain. So it's like an electric brain. Okay. Or
it's like German in that regard.
A little bit. Or like, yeah, washing machine. Xi ji, xi. Shi means to wash.
Uh-huh.
Yi means clothing.
Uh-huh.
And Ji means machine, wash, clothing, machine. So it's once you start to figure that out, like you can accumulate a lot of the nouns much, much faster once you got like the basics.
That's a little bit like German, right? Like they just sort of take the two words that make sense together and then slam them together.
Yeah.
And you've kind of got, and you've just got the word. So rather than having like a dentist and pediatrician and all these different types of doctor, you just know the word for doctor and then you know the word for teeth and you slam them together. You know the word for child, you know the word for doctor, you slam them together. Whereas in English, it's like you've got all these different, very specific words for all these
different Latin roots and all those things.
Yeah.
Yeah, like dentist is just tooth doctor.
Yeah.
It's very simple. So.
Yeah, that's really interesting, man.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to learn more about the cultural aspects and the people and everything like that. So language, of course, is part of that. That is super interesting. But what were some of the big differences you found, first initially and then now? Now that you've been there for a decade, what are some of the sort of big cultural differences or just things that really struck you about how different China or Chinese people are compared to the USA or perhaps the West in general?
I guess for the sake of this conversation, I'll speak in generalizations, even though I don't like to do that. You kind of have to.
I know. I know. We all understand. Look, there's over a billion people there.
Yeah.
You can't really just say Americans are like this. Chinese people are like this. Yeah. But
They're generally very, very hardworking, very friendly, very curious. You know, a lot of times, I guess the biggest shock when you go there, if you ever go there, have you been to China?
No, not yet.
Okay. So if you go there outside of Beijing and Shanghai, you'll certainly get stared at a lot.
Sure.
And that does, no matter what your skin color, as long as if it's not Asian, you're going to get stared at. Mm. That was kind of something you kind of got used to.
Yeah.
But there's nothing malicious about it. I didn't find.
Yeah.
It was just out of curiosity, you know, what's this person doing here? I've never seen a non-Chinese person walk down my street before or something.
Sure.
So that's a bit surprising. I think I was... They're very humble people, right? Usually very simple. Like they want to, you know, have a place to live, and they want harmony in their family. They want their family to be close. Their family ties are extremely close, right? Oftentimes, people will live with their parents until they go off and get married, often in their mid to late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this sort of unwritten hope or expectation that when the parents are old, that the children will move back in and take care of them.
Yeah,
kind of a repayment. Again, I'm generalizing a little bit, but a repayment for their sacrifice. And parents will sacrifice everything they have for their kids.
Yeah.
So I mean, a lot of that stuff is very. It's just very endearing, and it's very they're very sincere about it. I mean, those are a lot of the good things. There's other things that are a little more shocking, like the pollution. Obviously, it strikes you straight away. You're just like,
okay,
wow. You don't see the blue skies very much anymore.
Really? Wow. Okay.
It's like going outside and it's like, oh, it's a full moon tonight. Like, oh, I don't see this every day. You see the blue sky. It's like, oh, wow. It's blue sky today. That's great.
What's the population of Shanghai?
It's its own city province.
Yeah.
It's about 26 million in the province. In the downtown area is probably half of that.
Okay.
The urban area, I guess.
So it's like a whole country, essentially. Population-wise.
Yeah, it's like the size of Australia, basically. It's massive.
More people than Australia, isn't it?
Probably, so. Yeah. That's crazy. Yeah. It's big.
It's almost Canada.
Yeah, but I mean, it's certainly crowded, but I guess in my mind, I was expecting it to just be elbow-to-elbow everywhere you go, everything you do, and it's not. Like, I've certainly felt more crowded than, like Japan sometimes, or... Like there's other places that are more crowded. It certainly gets crowded at peak times in Shanghai, it's not completely overwhelming.
Yeah. And what's the living situation like? How do most people live? Do people tend to mainly live in apartments? Is it high-rise buildings? Is it flats? Is it houses? Is it suburbs? Yeah. A city of 26 million people, where do you put everybody?
Yeah, so I would say probably turn of the century, the 20th century, there was a lot of these just two, three level kind of low-rise brick buildings, and those were slowly replaced kind of with the communist era ones, which were six stories. Mm-hmm. And they just kind of all look the same. There's just block after block of these six-story buildings. I'm sure if you've been to Germany, you've probably seen stuff that kind of mm-hmm. looks like that.
Sure.
And those are slowly being replaced now with high-rises, which are actually really, really nice. And so we live in a high-rise at the moment. Well, I'm in the USA right now. If we get back to China, if and when,
yeah.
we'll return to our high-rise apartment. And China's—they're just building that stuff like nonstop. It's just—it's insane. Everywhere you go, you see the big cranes out in the distance, and they're just building those things as fast as they can. And a lot of times, like my wife's Chinese, and so her parents—they're in one of those six-story buildings. I think it's actually seven stories. There's some rule where if it's as long as the building's under seven stories, you don't need to put an elevator in it.
Okay.
So that's why the kind of buildings are kind of that tall. They're in the process of being relocated to a high rise, which is currently being built. You know, while they're waiting for this, they're getting paid by the government, and they had a few options. They could have relocated out to an existing one outside the city, but they want to stay in the city to be close to family and stuff. So yeah, you're going to see a lot of high rises. And the high rises now, they definitely take a lot more design, and they're, I don't know how you say, I don't want to say user friendly, but they're a lot more design incorporated into it. Whereas before it was very practical, and you just kind of walk into some of these older apartments, which still exist.
Yeah.
And you can rent them. Some of them have been renovated, and they kind of have that cute look to them, and people like them. But you'd walk in and be like, who designed this floor plan? It makes no sense. Why is the main bathroom in between the living room and the bedroom, or like, I don't know, just weird stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
that's funny, man. Yeah. So I'm actually curious, tell me about, you know, I don't want to get super personal, but I'm curious about the story of how you met your wife and what that was like. Cause that is a real, sort of coming together of cultures, especially cause you know, of course you've got her, but then you got like, you know, family and parents and everything like that. So what was that like?
Yeah, so Shanghai being the very international city it is, has a lot of clubs and sports clubs, including ice hockey club. I grew up playing ice hockey from Minnesota. And so when I went to Shanghai, I saw they had an ice hockey club. I'm like, oh, that's so cool. I could play ice hockey in China. Mm. And I brought my stuff with, and it was a great experience. But there was one hockey rink, and it was way outside the city, like an hour. Mm-hmm. And we'd all get in the bus and we'd go out there and play hockey and come back like once a week. And the league was pretty well organized. And basically my wife, she was getting her master's degree at the university right across the street from the rink. Mm-hmm. And she knew one of my friends who was also in the league. And he was like, well, we need like a scorekeeper, and we need somebody, we'll pay you, you know, a little bit, and you can help negotiate with the rink. Because obviously your English is good and your Chinese is good. And so they hired her. So I met her through that. She was the ice hockey scorekeeper girl, I guess you can say. Okay. That was her part-time job while she was going through grad school.
Awesome. And what was it like? I mean, where you, do her parents live in the city, or what was the meet the parents situation like? Were there any weird, funny stories or?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Plenty of those. Her parents live probably about 3 hours west of Shanghai, not in Shanghai. And to be quite honest, every single person in her family that I know of, except her cousin, who's also, you know, got a college education and went to work in Beijing, everybody out to aunt, great aunt, second cousin, third cousin, they all live in this one city. So obviously their family's very close.
Yeah.
And so I was reluctant to date someone from China, just, you know, like, thinking about the future, what are we going to do? You know, like which country we're going to live? Is it going to cause too much tension with the parents? But we started dating, and she was reluctant to tell her parents that I was the boyfriend at first. It was kind of, I was referred to as the friend.
Yes.
And I think we started dating in January, and then the next month was Chinese New Year. Mm-hmm. And so we were kind of deciding, like, should I go back with you to visit and meet your family or whatever? And I'm like, that's pretty early. And she's like, no, absolutely not.
Yeah.
Because in China, the tradition is if you bring someone home for Chinese New Year, that's the person you're going to marry.
Oh, so wow. Okay.
It's kind of a big deal. It's kind of like getting engaged almost, bringing them home to meet the family.
Okay.
And you know, you'd host a dinner, or you'd pay for one of the dinners for the family. And like announce like, okay, we're dating. So we waited till the following year to formally do that. Okay. but I met her parents before that. They were skeptical at first. I think sure. they hear a lot about the divorce rate in the US, which mm-hmm. is high, to be fair. It's a reasonable concern. Mm-hmm. But as they got to know me, I think they were okay with it.
Yeah.
And I think I was a little bit lucky in the sense because I've heard a lot of non-Chinese people getting married to Chinese people who had just really bad stories that,
yeah.
you know, I will disavow you if you marry this person.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
I forbid you. And my wife never shared with me while we were dating, but she obviously had a lot of conversations with her parents about it.
Yeah.
And so she, you know, after we were married, she kind of told me some of this stuff. Like, yeah, they really did not want you to yeah. date me. They wanted me to marry some nice boy from my hometown and we could live yeah. there forever. Da, da, da. So it was a little bit of an uphill battle, but yeah, she shielded me from it.
That's cool. No, that's cool, man. That's cool. You know, I think you can always overcome, but I think when you get to, especially the more disparate the cultures, the more likely there is going to be some resistance, not normally between the two people, right? But
yeah,
you know, parents and family, yep. et cetera. It's one of those things that I think in the West, especially, I think a lot of people think of, certainly in the modern era, a lot of people think of it just being like, okay, it's just the two people. And if the two people love each other, then that's fine. Like that's all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it's like in reality, especially in other cultures, you know, my family background is originally from Nigeria. Again, mm-hmm. a lot of the things you said about Chinese society exist in lots of African cultures, right? In terms of the families being tighter and there being more, it's more of a family-based culture
decision.
And a lot more, yeah, mm-hmm. a lot more traditionally based in that regard. So in that sense, it's kind of like there's another level of resistance that needs to be considered. And I think some people kind of aren't aware of that. And then some people are just not sort of ready for, okay, well, what about, you know, all these other things? So it's interesting to kind of know the stories there.
Yeah, I think marriage is more considered like a family decision
yeah.
as opposed to an individual decision. And, you know, when my wife, she was a little nervous meeting my parents. And I mean, they just loved her from the first second.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's like, that's it. That's all I got to do. You know? Yeah, just be yourself.
And yeah. yeah, no, it's a funny thing. So, I mean, what are some of the things that Westerners or Americans or people in general you feel get wrong about China? Part of the reason I ask this is because unfortunately for not a great reason, China's been in the news a lot recently.
Yeah.
With this whole situation, and there have been some dodgy things with the government, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
I also ask that because I don't know if you know this. I mean, I grew up in Saudi Arabia, right? So
yeah,
Saudi Arabia. Yeah. So Saudi Arabia is a country where most people haven't been there, but most people have very strong opinions and feelings mm-hmm. and whatever about it and expectations and assumptions. And I know in my life, I've been dealing with incorrect assumptions a lot. Right.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay, sometimes there is a kernel of truth. Sometimes people think something that is just totally false. Sometimes people think that something is much more major or prevalent or whatever than it is. So people always have incorrect opinions. And I believe that if you don't travel somewhere and spend time there and talk to people and understand a place which takes time, then I generally don't feel like it's wise to have a super duper strong opinion on a country, let alone the people in it. And I also think that a lot of people judge countries purely based on their governments, right? Or certain actions done by their governments or whatever. So I've come across people who have very negative perceptions of America, right? And their negative perceptions are based on, yeah, well, they started this war, or they did this, or the president did that, or their government did this, or whatever. And that is not, and some of those things could be correct, right? Sometimes they are correct.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
It's like there's a big difference between the American government, whoever is running it, and Americans in general, right? The American people, American culture, et cetera. So if someone has never been to the USA, they may have some totally warped perceptions about what the US is like or what Americans are like. And I think this is the case for every single country. And I know with China, I think that's another one of those countries, especially now, where people do have quite strong opinions or feelings or things that they may have heard or they may have thought or whatever. So I'd be curious to know what some of those things that people get wrong are, and maybe what some of the things they get right as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long list I could go through.
Yeah, go ahead.
And I was thinking the exact same thing. You know, like, I think tourism is kind of the great, I don't know, I don't want to say the great leveler, right? If people, I wish everybody from China could see America, and I wish everybody from America could visit China and see what it's actually like there. Mm-hmm. Because, like you said, without going there, you have all these preconceived notions. And I mean, so I obviously watch news from both sides. I don't know, how do I compare it? I think it's sort of like Donald Trump. Like, no matter what he says, CNN is never going to say anything good about him or what he does. You know, it's always going to be negative. I think you're kind of seeing that with China a little bit. Like, no matter what you think of them or what they do or what they say, 99% of the time, it's just kind of spun in a negative light. And some of that is probably earned. Like, if they do some stuff I definitely don't approve of. And mm-hmm. a lot of the stuff you hear is, it's always based on a, like you said, a kernel of truth.
Yeah.
It comes from something, but a lot of the times as a lot of these reports come out, there's a lot of things that are glossed over, mm-hmm. which those are kind of the annoying things. But I mean, gosh, where can I start? Obviously, the Chinese food is so different. It's so amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, safety, maybe a lot of people have this idea that, you know, if you go there, it's like North Korea and you could just be arrested anytime and put in prison for life or something like that. But in my experience traveling around China, it's extremely safe. As far as getting violence done to my person, like, I feel very safe. I tell people this way, there's not a place I haven't been to a place in China where I wouldn't feel comfortable walking around at 3 a.m. in the morning by myself.
Okay.
I don't fear violence at all. Maybe, you know, if I was a very outspoken political dissident or activist,
sure,
then I would probably fear for political, you know, reaction from the government or something mm-hmm. like that. You know, I guess a lot of people think everybody over there eats dogs, and that does happen. It's not widespread. I've heard there's a dog restaurant in Shanghai. I've never seen it.
Okay.
I know that's changing quickly. You know, like Shenzhen is a big city right across from Hong Kong, down mm-hmm. southern China. And they just, this year, they banned consumption of cats and dogs.
Okay.
To start. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you see a lot of news now, like, we need to decouple with China. Okay, maybe that's a nice thought, but we're mm-hmm. so intertwined with China, the whole world, especially the U.S., mm-hmm. That's just kind of a pipe dream to me. I mean, just go one day without using something
made in China.
Yeah. Try it. see if you can do it. I bet you can't.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're so intertwined there, and I don't know what that looks like going forward. I don't know. Should we decouple? I don't know.
It's not. I don't think it's a question for us to answer, really, is it?
Exactly.
That's kind of beyond our pay grade.
Mm-hmm. And you know, I guess there's another idea that China can't develop its own technology, that they steal everything from the West. And certainly they have stolen a fair amount of technology through these forced transfers, it doesn't mean like every company has to transfer their technology. It's like when you open a business in China, you have to do a joint venture with the Chinese company.
Okay.
And the Chinese half may require you to, as part of the deal, to transfer your technology over. And but you know, people say it's forced.
Yes.
But at the end of the day, I mean, those companies are willing participants in this technology transfer. And there's some stolen things. You know, there's obviously espionage going on and other things like that. But a lot of those are companies that are just willing to, okay, I want part of the Chinese market. Mm-hmm. I'm willing to give up my technology for that, you know. Mm-hmm. And they do have a lot of their own technology, like the WeChat Pay and Alipay, the mobile payment systems.
Yeah.
They're really convenient. You know, there's obviously some concerns about data collection and mm-hmm. how those could be used to track people. The mail delivery service is phenomenally fast. Like when you order stuff, you know, DJI is a great company. They make all the drones. They're the leader in drone technology.
Yeah.
I mean, they have a lot of their own technology as well. So gosh, what else could I say?
What's the, what's the internet situation like over there? Cause they have
not good.
Okay. Yeah. Tell us more about that, because I know that firstly, the social media networks that people use and that are popular are totally different. And then also they've got the sort of, what do they call it? The great firewall situation.
The great firewall.
Some places can be accessed, but certain websites cannot. And there's certain levels of censorship and things like that.
Yeah. So the censorship, I think since Xi Jinping has taken over has definitely gone up to a new level.
Okay.
When I first got there in 2007, like, it was great. I could do anything, go on any website and say pretty much whatever you wanted. It didn't seem to have any retribution or whatever, you know, Hu Jintao. It seemed like the country was getting more and more open. And I think that's gone backwards a little bit. There's just been extremely strict censorship. And I've tried to put some of that stuff in my videos. Predominantly when I upload it, let's call it the Chinese version of YouTube. You know, there's just one YouTube, but in China, there's like 10 competing YouTubes.
Oh, interesting.
And okay. So I got to upload all my stuff to all these different platforms.
Oh, that's interesting.
And they're required to self-censor, essentially, right? And so sometimes they have different censorship standards amongst themselves. Mm. So I may make a video talking about, what did I do the other day? Oh, just talking about just different things that were happening with the coronavirus, what's true and what's not.
Oh, yeah. You know,
did it really come from the Wuhan lab, or did it... was it brought over by the U.S. military to China and these kind of things? And I think it went through on one of the platforms, but the other ones, they blocked it. So basically what happens, you upload a video, you hit, you know, send, and it just goes into, we are checking mode, and you have to wait an hour. If it passes the check, it'll go. If not,
and
sorry,
you
violated the rules.
Is that a human check or an algorithm?
Yeah, it's a human check.
Wow. On every single video uploaded?
Every single video.
Wow, that's crazy.
Yeah. And probably especially... I can't prove this. This is just my conspiracy theory here.
Yeah.
Probably especially on foreign voices.
Oh, that's interesting.
Non-local voices. But we don't know for sure. Yeah, I mean, YouTube, Twitter, all this stuff's blocked. A lot of people use VPNs to get over it. And that's such a gray area. No one really knows what's... technically, it's illegal, but it's just kind of allowed.
Yeah.
And they can turn it off. I know they can, because whenever they have like an important meeting coming up, like they're doing a really important meeting right now called the two sessions, the governmental meeting. And if something comes up, or, you know, like the anniversary of Tiananmen coming up, the VPN just won't work for the day.
Really?
Yeah. So, wow. I mean, they can turn it off, but they kind of allow it.
Okay.
It's just something that's just a mystery to all of us living there. But I mean, obviously on my YouTube channel, most of those people are getting over the firewall.
Yeah.
And coming on YouTube to watch my stuff.
Yeah.
Which surprised me, because I initially didn't, for the first 2 years, I didn't put anything on YouTube. Then I started to try it. And I was like, there's a lot of people watching. So it's interesting.
That's really interesting. Yeah. So are there specific laws of certain things that you can't say or can't talk about? Or is it more like you can't do it, but there aren't really laws? How explicit is it? How clear are these rules or guidelines?
Not incredibly clear.
Okay.
And I think that's probably intentional.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I did an interview with one of my friends who you know, grew up in the former Soviet Union, and he said that, the rules were specifically quite unclear. So
yeah.
That, you know, like that sort of helps in itself.
Yeah. So on most platforms, I'm not allowed to live stream as, because I'm not Chinese, not a Chinese citizen. So, I mean, that limits me somewhat to being able to get my classes out there and my income. But it's a tricky situation for sure.
Yeah, no, I get that. Is it possible to become a citizen as a non-Chinese person?
I've heard it's been done.
Okay.
I don't know the exact process. They've recently made new laws to open the green card process and make that a little more clear. And it's still a little vague, but it's much more, there's like 8 different paths now to getting a green card.
Is that a green card for China?
Yeah. So if you get it, which I actually applied for it, but then all this stuff happened. If you get it, it's basically, you can live and work, just kind of come back and forth for 10 years. And then as long as I think you have to be in China 365 days out of 5 years, to maintain it, to keep it going.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice step in progress, because sometimes you kind of feel maybe they just don't want us here. Like, I don't know. So we'll see if that goes through or not. I'm not holding my breath, because everything else going on in the world right now. Like, I can't even get back into China.
Yeah, yeah. Were you in China when this situation started breaking out?
Yeah. So I had originally, my wife and I had planned to come back to the U.S. to visit my parents February 4th. That was when we booked our flight last year.
Okay.
And all this stuff started precipitating, and we were just kind of like, we should change our flight. And like, no, we'll be okay. And then it was like January 27th, United and Delta announced, okay, we're canceling all flights February 1st and on.
Okay.
So like, okay, we better change our flight because we're on American. They hadn't made an announcement yet. And so we changed it and then we left. It wasn't to escape the virus necessarily, but we just wanted to kind of continue on with the travel we'd already paid for and planned. And now we just can't go back. Fortunately, she has 6 months on her visa, but it might be longer than that.
Gotcha. No, that's really interesting. I'm trying to think if there's any other big question. I mean, what questions do you get most often? What do people ask you? I guess on both sides, in fact, in China, what are people curious to know about America or the West? And when you're back in the States, what are the questions you get most often about China?
Yeah. I mean, people in China, they really want to know is the U.S. really that open? Because they see all the movies and the TV shows and they're very hypersexualized. And I was like, is it really like that? And conversely, I think you have a lot of, if you've never been to China and you watch only Fox News or something, you kind of have this idea that China is not far off North Korea. And, you know, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, it probably was. But yeah, so you get a lot of that, those types of questions where people actually might fear going over there. And reality is people have been doing business for years over there. And you do have to kind of watch what you say, obviously. And there's a lot of things I'd like to see. I'd like China. I'd like to see them to change for the better. I'd like to see America change for the better. There's a lot of criticisms I have of my own country.
Okay, I'm curious. What would those be? What are the couple of things or what are a few things you think that China could learn from America? And what are a few things you think America could learn from China?
Well, I think the biggest thing for me is I tend to lean towards pacifism. And I think the U.S. is definitely too involved in wars and has been for pretty much my lifetime. Almost every president I've been in my lifetime has been very involved in wars in the Middle East.
Sure.
And I don't know what the answer is at all for that.
It's complicated. Very
yeah.
Much.
Yeah. And I would like to see, in China, a little bit more freedom of expression. I guess they value harmony and stability over everything there. And you look at our political situation in the U.S. and people arguing, or even the U.K., I think they just think it's not stable there. Like, why would we want that, right? And so why would we want a democracy when we have the stability? Supposed stability, right? I mean, it's not that we're unstable, like economically, we're still very successful. Mm-hmm. They just see all this political stuff as a distraction. Mm-hmm. And so, but, it's really hard to talk about those things over there, especially on a public forum like the internet.
Yes.
You can talk about them with friends. Sure, that's not a big issue, but they'll mostly be censored.
So if you were to talk about America, I would say the core fundamental value of America is freedom or liberty.
Yeah.
What would you say it is in China? Would you say it's stability?
Stability and harmony.
Stability and harmony. That's really interesting because
this
is something I'm always trying to explain to people who haven't traveled a lot, because a lot of people assume that whatever the fundamental primary value in their country is, they paint with that same, they view the whole world through that lens.
Yeah.
So they can only compare things in terms of freedom and liberty, right? So if I'm talking about Saudi Arabia, they're just talking about liberty and freedom and liberty and freedom. And I'm trying to explain, like, look, I understand you because I can see with that lens too, but not all countries, not all cultures, not all peoples, that's not necessarily the thing that they are trying to maximize. So if you're trying to maximize stability, you don't maximize liberty, right? If you're trying to maximize adherence to a certain religion, if you're trying to maximize family values, if you're trying to maximize economic success, whatever it is, you may need to, ideally you don't want to compromise everything and it's not like you flatten this one to maximize that one, but there's a sliding scale, right? If you offer maximum liberty and maximum freedom, take a simple thing, right? You could even compare the UK or Europe versus USA, okay? The right to bear arms, okay?
Yeah.
If you talk to a freedom loving, libertarian minded American, heck yeah, no one's taking our guns. Like, I guess, all right, whatever. Like, and I get that. I understand that. In fact, I support the Second Amendment for the US. But if I look through a British lens or you look through the European lens, people are like, oh my gosh, those Americans, what are they doing? They're crazy. They're having shootouts at schools.
Yep.
They're having all this gun crime. They're looking at the numbers. They're like, this is crazy. Just get rid of all the guns. and people aren't able, even between the UK and USA, which are more similar, in the UK, most British people, like the Second Amendment is totally foreign to them. Like they can't even fathom the concept of allowing citizens to own all of these guns, et cetera. So I'm always trying to help to get people to understand it. I'm always trying to say, like, look, not every society, not every country just has the exact same fundamental concepts. And then, of course, you have different histories, you have different cultures, you have different religious backgrounds, all of these things. They all play into it. You can't just turn Saudi Arabia into America, right? You can't just turn China into Germany, just like you can't just turn Germany into Iran. Like they're just different. And yeah, sure, you might think this one is better than the other overall or whatever. And that's a whole nother conversation. But it strikes me that a lot of people just don't really understand the fact that core values can be different. And
it's silly to think that way, you know. Yeah. Like, I think some people think China just needs to become a democracy, and it's just that simple.
Yeah,
and everything will turn around. I don't know. I mean, yeah, Sure, that'd be great, but I don't know. Is that the only solution? You know,
it's complicated.
Become a democracy.
It's complicated. And look, you were talking about U.S. intervention, right? Let's not pretend that the USA has not tried to instill,
exactly,
create democracy in certain countries in the Middle East, and the results have been, as far as I can tell, pretty disastrous, right?
Not good.
You
yeah,
now have failed exactly. states. You've now got places where they are worse. Look at Libya. Look at Iraq, right? They're now worse than they were under their dictators, you know, to be frank. And this is not me saying, oh, Saddam Hussein was a great guy, Gaddafi was a great guy. No, that's not this what you're saying.
Yeah.
But stuff is just complicated, right? Like it's complicated. It's not as simple as like, okay, you just snap your fingers, you do this, and everything else falls in line, because there's going to be stuff you cannot predict. And, you know, you're going to get power vacuums, and you're going to get certain groups and militias and whatever who are going to come in. And, you know, you've had the rise of ISIS. And I am no expert on all this stuff, but I can certainly look at it and go, this is not simple. This is not a one size fits all. Oh, you just do
exactly.
this and it works. It's very complicated.
But a lot of people think that way, and they think in oversimplified terms, and they think in binary, like it's got to be this or that. And it's just not the way the world works in the majority of diplomatic relations. And so, I would love to see a little more openness on the internet. A little less censorship, because the problem is, you know, you could say, well, you know, China, if you took a vote right now, a democratic vote in China, I would bet my life savings that they would overwhelmingly, like Xi Jinping would overwhelmingly win in a landslide, right?
Okay.
You know, the Communist Party would remain in power just because people, again, like that stability. And so how do you, you know, if you think in those terms, like how do you give a democratic government to a country that just doesn't want it, you know?
People need to want it. Yeah, people need to want it.
So yeah, it's very complicated, and again, I don't think democracy is the best solution or the only solution. But I think they call it technically, what would be the label for China would be sort of be like authoritarian capitalism right now.
Sure,
it's really not even communism. That's just another thing I hear people say. Oh, it's just a bunch of, you know, crazy commies running around trying to rule the world. Like, well, they have an authoritarian structure for sure, but and they have a lot of state-owned enterprises, but it's not all state-owned. There's a lot of private business, and the party's all involved in the private businesses as well. But it's changes like that just don't happen so quickly.
It's not. You know, I spoke to someone recently. I did a podcast recently. I was talking to a guy who's been to North Korea. And so I was talking, you know, you don't meet a lot of people who have actually been to North Korea. So that was a really fascinating.
My wife went there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. She was, she had some interesting stories. Everything's choreographed. It's quite interesting.
Yeah, man.
So
awesome, Mike. So where can people find you online?
Yeah. So on my YouTube and Facebook, it's just Teacher Mike. Mm-hmm. If you're a Chinese speaker listening to this, it's Mike Lauscher. on Chinese social media, it's the same thing. If you type my name in, Mike Lauscher, you'll certainly find me on all my Chinese platforms, which are many.
Awesome.
So,
hopefully, maybe you can help us out by subtitling this video. getting someone to do it, that would be cool. Like maybe, you know, this could reach a whole different audience if that can be done. That would be dope.
Yeah. And you have to, in China, you have to pretty much subtitle everything because they want to make sure they know what you're saying. And it's just kind of standard, even in Chinese, because there's so many dialects and stuff. They just subtitle everything.
Awesome, Mike. Thank you so much for coming on the show, man. It's been
my pleasure.
Been really interesting talking to you.
You too. Thanks for having me.
No doubt, man. Take care.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.